Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia, and I'm also currently a Danish Diabetes and Endocrine Academy visiting professor at the University of Copenhagen. The goal of Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research, so exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, exercise and health. And what I'm really wanting is for people to get their exercise information from the research leaders rather than influencers. And indeed, today I bring to you Emeritus Professor Michael Gleeson from Loughborough University, who's been a big name in exercise and the immune system and the effects of nutrition on the immune system for many, many years. What was clear from the discussion is that exercise in general is good for your immune system, so it makes it less likely that you'll develop infections. However, if you're exercising at a very high level, so a high exercise load, whether it's volume, intensity, et cetera, so such as an elite athlete, you have an increased risk of illness and infection because you do get a decrease in your immune function. I found it very interesting. I think you will too, so stick around. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Inside Exercise. Thanks for coming on. How are you?
Hey, very good, Glenn. Thanks. So please call me Mike, as most people do. That's great.
Oh, yes. Okay, I will. I was just saying, just before we came on, I said, I don't actually know a whole lot about the immune system. I'm more an exercise and muscle metabolism guy, although I've managed to get all these strange sicknesses. So I've had dengue fever, I've had cellulitis, I've had deep vein thrombosis somehow. And now here I am with a, I've just broken my clavicle cycling a few days ago here in Copenhagen. So I managed to sort of do some damage to myself, but I'm no sort of extra on the immune system. So I'm looking forward to learning a bit more from you as the listeners will and the people watching. That's the other thing. What a few people say to me, they don't realize they can actually watch this. So if you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or something else, keep in mind you can actually, if you want to see what Mike looks like, you can have a look on YouTube as well. Thanks for coming on. How about we start off by giving me a bit of background on your illustrious career and how you retired in 2016, but you're good enough to still come on. So maybe let us know were you like an athlete originally and then you got into academia, or you're an academic first and then took an interest in exercise and sports immunology, or how did you end up doing what you did?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've never been an athlete or anything close to it. I enjoy things like recreational tennis. I used to play a bit of football, and now I that's my kind of my favorite spectator sport, soccer. I started life in academia, you know, as a student doing a first degree in biochemistry, actually. That was at University of Birmingham. And then I was lucky enough to get a PhD position where I was going to do some work on the effects of diet and exercise on energy metabolism. So that's what kind of got me interested in the exercise side of things from a science perspective. And since that PhD, I then went on. I was actually mostly doing animal work, so with rats, and later actually with bird species, mostly chickens. Can you imagine me sort of sitting behind a treadmill and encouraging a chicken to train on a treadmill? Well, we measured various aspects of its respiratory function and took blood samples before and after the exercise, that kind of thing.
We got sheep running on a treadmill once, but never tried a chicken.
Chickens. Yeah, and then after spending some time as a lecturer at a veterinary school, actually in Edinburgh in Scotland, then had an opportunity to move over into human research. And that's when I joined up with Ron Maughan at Aberdeen University. And he'd got a bunch of PhD students and people like, including people like you'd know of, like Paul Greenhalgh and Bruce Griffin, Alan Donnelly, these guys. So we had a good team up there for probably a number of years, about 3 years while I was there doing the postdoc. And then we got in, we were doing all the exercise form and stuff. Paul was doing his high intensity exercise and the effects of acid-base balance on performance and that. Others were doing lipid metabolism in relation to exercise. I was doing mostly to do with things like supplements, like and glycerol consumption, and its effects on exercise performance. And then from there, decided to move on to actually try and get a permanent job. So ended up going lecturing down in the Midlands of England, firstly at Coventry, and then moving on to Birmingham University, and finally Loughborough. And it was probably while I was at Coventry University that I actually started doing research on exercise and immune function. And the main thing that prompted me to do that was hearing a lecture by Eric Newshome, who I'm sure you've heard of, from the University of Oxford, who was doing some pioneering work on the effects of glutamine supplementation. He'd observed, you know, drops in plasma glutamine with prolonged exercise, and this seemed to be associated with reductions in lymphocyte proliferation in response to antigens, the foreign chemicals that stimulate them to proliferate. And that got me interested in that, as to, well, how does exercise affect immunity, and what can you do about it? Can you do anything from a sort of a nutritional perspective, or is it more to do with the amount of and level of training that you're doing? What other factors might influence immunity? Supplements, or maybe even things like sleep quality, even got into
later. It was pretty wide open back. When was that again? It was pretty.
Oh, that would have been sort of the late 1980s.
Okay.
That was just when the field was really kicking off, just starting really.
It became a branch. Big name in biochemistry. So just tell me again. So you're saying during prolonged exercise, glutamine is decreasing?
When you do prolonged exercise, your plasma glutamine drops by about anything between 30 and 50%.
Wow.
And that was suggested as the reason.
Amino acids tend to increase during prolonged exercise. So
probably most of them do. But yeah, glutamine is a bit different. It goes down. And because glutamine is a known essential amino acid for lymphocyte proliferation, and proliferation of any cell types, for that matter, that suggested, the hypothesis was that might be the reason why people, athletes, they were observing decreased aspects of immune function. And that might also account for why they tended to get fairly high levels of infection, particularly amongst the endurance athletes. The seen as a problem at the time, 20, 30 years ago, that these endurance athletes would, the likes of David Moorcroft, Liz McColgan, the ones I know from the UK, would be always coming on TV doing interviews and, why didn't you compete, or how come you didn't perform that well? Well, I came down with an infection. And
So
that's what prompted it all.
So do you want to keep going on, explaining your career, or and then we'll get back to some of this stuff?
That's probably enough on me. People can always look me up on the on the internet,
so
or the university website.
Officially retired in 2016, but you're still very active. You've got books. I think you said you've got the fifth edition or fourth edition of sports nutrition book coming out. Is that right?
The sport nutrition book, which has been going since 2004, was when the first edition appeared. We've done a few updates, three so far. The last one was 2018, and we were asked to do another update by the publisher. But this time we were a bit more sticky. We said we wanted a few more royalties this time. And also it would be great if we could have the book in full colour. And the great thing was they actually agreed to that, particularly the full colour thing. So, we'll have full colour infographics, which we never had in there before. All the figures will be in colour. There'll be a lot more photos. Mm. But it'll look a much more attractive book than the original or the black, white and blue version.
And that's with Oscar Jugendrup. And I've known him from way back. We were both doing similar stuff way back. I was actually at his PhD defense in 1997 at the University of Maastricht. But I want to actually send me his email address, if you don't mind, because I want to ask him on the podcast. And I've been having trouble.
Well, he'd be another great guy to have on. Yeah, indeed. I will.
All right. So why don't you tell me, so I was interested, you were saying even back in the, 1980s or whatever, people were aware that, I guess, when did people start to become aware that athletes, especially endurance athletes, I guess, were getting more infections and upper airway tract, you know, coughs and sputters and things? And is there good evidence for that? Like, you know, how much do they get per year compared to someone that doesn't exercise, for example?
Yeah, well, certainly in those days, it seemed to be a significant problem for those who were doing long hours of training and competing in endurance types events. And a few of the studies that were done by the likes of David Neiman showed that if you ran a marathon, then you'd have a higher incidence of upper respiratory tract infections, which is the most common infection all of us get, really, the common cold, essentially, from a variety of different viruses. That the more people were coming down with infection than those people who acted as controls, who'd actually trained for the race but didn't actually compete in the in the marathon. So that provided some evidence that there was a potential problem with endurance exercise, and that led people doing studies to see, well, let's see how the immune system is actually responding to exercise. Is there evidence of immune depression, a lowering of immunity following stressful, prolonged exercise? That that kind of proved to be the case. There were hundreds of laboratory-based studies showing that, you know, if you cycle for or run on a treadmill for probably more than about 90 minutes, you start to see the sort of a depression, lowering of a variety of immune cell functions, both related to innate immunity, in other words, our kind of our first line of defense, things like neutrophil oxidative burst activity, which kills bacteria. Almost stop the microbes in their tracks, as it were, before they can actually cause infection symptoms in the body. And then also the acquired immune system, which is sort of governed mostly by a different type of white blood cell, the macrophages and the lymphocytes, that help to also when you become infected with some foreign material, usually a virus or a bacteria, it can also, when it responds, the immune system on the adaptive side can also induce what we call immunological memory. But if you do come across that same pathogen again, you're much less likely to develop symptoms of illness, because you clear it much more quickly from the body, as the immune system gets upregulated and active much more quickly than when you first encounter a pathogen you've never encountered before, something like COVID, for example.
Mm-hmm. So what is happening with the athletes then? So is there a change in their, so you said the burst activity. So when you first see that pathogen and you fight it with the leukocytes, so maybe explain the different white blood cells and things, just very basically. But then you've got that acquired immunity. I would have thought the athletes, if they're getting sick often, they would have a better acquired immunity. Who knows what's actually going astray there in the athletes?
What's the original theory, and it's pretty much the same today, is that you do get a degree of depression of immunity following prolonged stressful events. Now, that can be something like exercise, like running a marathon, for example, or it can even be other things that cause stress, like a lack of sleep or psychological stress, for example. And you get this depression of immunity, and that's what was suggested to be responsible for this increase in infection in the week, infection risk in the week or two following the sort of a stressful endurance events.
So are there white cell numbers down, or they're just not the burst activity you mentioned earlier? Like, what's actually going wrong at this sort of cellular level?
Yeah, it's not actually the numbers going down, because actually when you exercise, the actual numbers of white blood cells actually go up. In your blood circulation, you've got these white blood cells floating around in the blood, in the fluid, along with the red blood cells. But you've also got a significant number, probably almost as many as you've got circulating. They're actually stuck to the blood vessel wall, the endothelium. And when you exercise, increases in adrenaline and other hormones, as well as the increase in blood flow through the blood vessels, particularly to the lung, the heart, and the, you know, and the muscles, that washes off these adhered white blood cells into the circulation. So after a marathon, for example, you can easily see something like a doubling of the white blood cell count. But what you see in concert with that is a depression of a variety of immune cell functions, including their specifically their ability to either ingest and kill microbes or produce cytokines which activate the immune system, or to proliferate the lymphocytes in response to the immune challenge. So a variety of things go down, and it seems to be that functional thing that's important rather than the actual numbers that you have in the circulation at the time, because effectively, you remember, you'll get the infections generally come in through the upper airways and then into your lung, or you get them by eating, you know, bacteria and other nasty things that you've got in contaminated food or poor food hygiene, and then you get gut infections. I mean, those are the two most common infections in athletes.
And we do we know, so it's quite interesting, because I guess if you didn't have that increase in circulating white blood cells during exercise, then it would be worse, because, you know, if the function's down, but you've got more, I guess it's some sort of compensation there. But do we know why the function goes down? Do you know, what's...
There's a variety of reasons, but they're linked really to increases in stress hormones, particularly adrenaline and cortisol. Cortisol, most people will know, if you have it in a topical cream, is hydrocortisone, and it's an anti-inflammatory medication you can use. In the body, the cortisol is also anti-inflammatory, and it also causes immunodepression. When you exercise, cortisol goes up, and once it's gone up, it tends to stay up for several hours because it's got a half-life of hours in the circulation, so it sticks around for quite a bit of time when you're stressed. And this has been shown to depress a variety of immune cell functions. On top of that, you also have an increase usually in a compound called interleukin-6 or IL-6. And this initiates a anti-inflammatory or immunosuppressive cascade by stimulating the release of other anti-inflammatory cytokines, including the most potent one we know of, which is interleukin-10 or IL-10. You also get a down-regulation of the receptors on your white blood cell that are actually there to detect the presence of bacteria and viruses. These are called whole light receptors. And both their expression on the cell surface of white blood cells and the subsequent signaling pathways that cause activation of the acquired immune system, they're all decreased by exercise. There's even been some studies showing that if you do prolonged exercise, where they've measured gene expression in white blood cells, that there's a substantial upregulation of all these proteins for anti-inflammatory pathways and a downregulation of the pro-inflammatory ones that promote the immune response. So there's a good sort of mechanistic link there between stress, lowering of immunity, and that being a likely reason for the increase incidence of infection amongst athletes in endurance type events or during intensified periods of training leading up to competition.
It's interesting. I just thought when you said about adrenaline and cortisol increasing during prolonged exercise, I did a bunch of studies for a while there with carbohydrate ingestion during prolonged exercise, And when you drink carbohydrate, you actually attenuate the increases in adrenaline and cortisol because, you know, they're partly to so the adrenaline stimulates liver glucose output, and you don't, you know, it does other things as well, like stimulating glycogen breakdown, but you don't need that when you're ingesting carbohydrate. And also the cortisol's, you know, having effects on fat, et cetera, which you don't need when you're drinking. So I wonder if people that drink carbohydrate throughout exercise over and over, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend, especially if it's just in training, I wonder if they actually get less of less infections.
We certainly know that, like you say, if you do take on board carbohydrate during exercise, it diminishes that stress hormone response. It also diminishes the interleukin 6 response to exercise that induces the anti-inflammatory cascade afterwards. And we actually did some studies on that in the lab, measuring cortisol, measuring IL-6, and also measuring a variety of immune cell function. And you could see that with the, say, for example, for cytokine production by lymphocytes, one of the reactions to that you want when you want your immune system activated, that was actually decreased with the exercise when you were just drinking water, essentially, or, you know, a non-carbohydrate containing placebo, just artificially sweetened. But if you had the carbohydrate, that decrease in immune function was almost completely eliminated. At least for that measure, it doesn't do it for everything. Like for natural killer cell activity, that doesn't really seem to be sensitive to that effect. But for some markers of immunity, it does actually, you know, prevent them from falling, or prevent them from falling as much as they would if you were doing exercise in the fasted state. So, you know, out of that came the recommendation to perhaps you know, if you're doing prolonged exercise, then not a bad idea to consume carbohydrate during exercise. This was all before all the low glycogen and the affecting training adaptation and all that thing with the train low thing. But that was the case. But there's not really been any studies that have actually shown that doing that actually decreases infection incidence. I mean, the only types of studies that have been done have been sort of comparing people who have take on carbohydrate during exercise in a marathon compared to those who don't or only have a fairly low intake, and that didn't seem to reveal any differences in infection incidence as a result of that. And I think now, the present day, we kind of consider the sort of exercise or the lowering of immunity that you do see in athletes engaged in heavy training, for example, is actually a multifactorial thing. Yes, you've got the stress, physical stress of the exercise and the rise in the hormones and the anti-inflammatory cytokines, but you've also got potentially other influences as well. And one is the nutritional status of the individual, particularly whether they've got enough vitamin D in their system. The other are things like sleep quality. When you athletes generally have poorer sleep quality than, you know, your average guy in the street. When they perform intensified training, and we showed this in a few studies at Loughborough, their sleep quality goes down even further. If you look at sleep efficiency, for example, which is the percentage of time you actually spend asleep when you put your head on the pillow and the lights are out and you're intending to go to sleep, you know, in the normal, shall we say, healthy population or non-active or only recreationally active people, they will get maybe their sleep efficiency will be somewhere between 92 and 97%. In other words, for most people, when your head hits the pillow, probably only a few minutes before you're nodding off sleep, and you don't get many awakenings during the night until you wake up in the morning, you know, and you've usually got then a good sort of 7-8 hour sleep maybe. But with the athletes, their sleep efficiency normally is something below 90%, and when, or 90 to 92%, something of that order. And when they did a week of intensified training, by the end of that they were down to 85%. And this is not just the latency in actually going off to sleep when you put your head on the pillow, but also arises with increased awakenings during the night. So you're not having a deep sleep, so it's not as restorative. This seems to have some impact on immunity, and we know it can increase the susceptibility to developing infections when you're exposed to a virus. There were some lovely studies done by Cohen et al., who actually stuck some of the nasal spray up the nose, which contained the rhinovirus, one of the more common viruses that causes the common cold. And they did this in a number of people. And they've also done it sort of in sleep deprivation studies as well. Clearly, if you get less than 7 hours of sleep per night, or if you have relatively low sleep efficiency, your chance of actually developing respiratory infection when exposed to exactly the same dose of virus as somebody who has good sleep quality, it can increase your risk of developing infection by about 3 to 5-fold. So it's a big effect.
Wow.
It's a lack of sleep quality or quantity. And when you exercise, you say, you know, that sleep quality goes down. And you've also got sort of psychological stress. We know chronic psychological stress is associated with increased risk of infection and depressed immunity, maybe through chronically elevated levels of cortisol and other stress hormones, for example. And of course, when athletes are competing, they're going to get more stressed, anxiety and competition, etc. And also, actually, just when they're doing hard training, if you measure what's happening to their mood state, it's always going down. As they come fatigued, they become more depressed, you know. And if you're not performing well, if you're off form in a team sport or something like that, it's all these added
stresses.
You're
worried not to be selected or something.
Well, yeah, plus all the social media trolls you get nowadays having a go at you if you're not performing well. You know, there's a whole bunch of stresses. And then you've got, you know, elite athletes traveling to competition, you know, thousands of miles away. So they're going over several time zones and air travel. And that brings its own problems as well. That's also associated with increased risk of infection. If you're traveling across more than 3 time zones, you're more likely to pick up infections in that situation. So all those things combining together, you know, mean there's a bit of a load on the athlete there that tends to lower their immunity.
So it becomes a lot more complicated then to try and work out why athletes, especially, you know, professional type athletes, as you said, that they have all these other extra stresses, social media and flying time zones and things. Becomes more complicated to try and work out why they're getting more infections. I guess, I wonder if people have looked at just, you know, strata, I'm assuming they have, stratifying. So looking at people that don't really exercise and doing a little bit more, you know, hours per week or intensity, et cetera. Have they been able to sort of stratify? Because isn't it right? The old thinking, just all I've got at the moment, I think, was that, you know, not doing much exercise at all was not good for your immune system. Doing a little bit was good for it, but then doing a whole bunch was maybe not good for it, which is, I guess, the way we've been sort of chatting here. Do we know that sort of stratification? And
that's essentially what the evidence shows. It's not always clear, you know, what aspect of immunity it is that sort of particularly responsible, or whether it's, you know, multiple aspects of immunity that are responsible for this improvement or increase in infection risk with doing exercise. But yeah, what you're referring to is essentially the classic J-shaped curve, called coined by David Neeman back in the 1990s, I think, compared to a sedentary couch potato, for example, if you're doing moderate exercise on a regular basis, say doing sort of, you know, sort of jogging for an hour and a half a day, and you're doing that on a regular basis, say 5 days or more a week, then you actually see then a reduction in your susceptibility to the common cold, to upper respiratory tract infection. And some fairly large-scale studies David Neben did one covering about over 1,000 participants looking at things like how much, what was their level of physical activity. And yeah, with that moderate level of activity compared to the sedentary person, you saw something like a 30 to 50% reduction in the incidence rate of upper respiratory tract infection. So there's clearly some benefit of doing moderate activity, and that has been ascribed to actually this part of this increase in white blood cell numbers that you get with exercise, and also an absence of any decrease in actual functional activity. Function. Okay. So you've got the same immune status, but you've got more cells circulating around there. And then people like Richard Simpson started to look at, well, the cells that are coming into the circulation, are they the same that are those that are already around floating around when you're at rest, or are we getting something different that might actually further improve immune function? And what he observed was that you get increased numbers of, in particular, natural killer cells and T cells, the type of lymphocyte that are actually primed and ready to fight infection. So you could think of it as as an army mobilizing your troops.
So you get that during the acute exercise, you get an increase.
And you get that with acute exercise, and provided you don't do it too long or too hard, then you don't get that depression of immune function, and you're mobilizing these cells. So it's envisaged as being kind of a what you would call an increased immune surveillance. Because these then cells, once they come into the circulation, they'll either go back after the exercise, partly to, back to the blood vessel walls, but quite a number of them also leave the circulation. And they tend to go to the areas where you might need them if you're getting infected, to the lungs and to the gut. So that's the main reason we think the moderate exercise is beneficial for immune function and therefore is associated with a lower risk of infection. But when you do the much longer, harder stuff that the elite athletes are doing, then this is where it goes the other way, and you end up getting depressed immunity despite those elevated cell numbers, and that depressed immunity can last for quite a number of hours, even up to 24 hours after your last exercise bout, if you've had large sustained increases in interleukin 6 and cortisol. And of course, if you're doing that day after day, then you tend to get a summative effect. You get a bit of a drop on the first day. Mm-hmm. If you do the same the next day without any, recovery days in between, it's going to go down progressively. And we actually did some studies that showed that phenomenon in the lab, where we had a bunch of cyclists who normally train 3 hours a day, which is quite a lot. But we doubled their, they did an hour and a half a day normally, and then we doubled their training load for a whole week with no recovery days. We took blood samples before and after the exercise and for several hours afterwards, and we found that by the end of that week, they'd got sort of an accumulative decrease, much more than you would get with a single bout of exercise. It was down by about 50%, several aspects of their immune function, both on the innate and the acquired side of immunity. And that was observed in blood samples that were actually taken 12 hours since their last training session. So it wasn't a carryover just from the last bout they'd done. It was something that was there and was going to stick around perhaps until you have a recovery day or two.
Well, I'm glad we got that out, because for a while there it was sounding a bit depressing with exercise reducing immune function. But essentially, for most people who are not sort of training a whole bunch, so probably 99% of people that are going out there and doing some exercise, you said even an hour and a half. Well, you said jogging an hour and a half 5 days a week. That's quite a lot. So probably 90. I don't know. I'm trying to put a number on it.
Yeah,
I mean, exercise is good for the immune system, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the optimum benefit seems to be from doing, well, if you're a man, actually up to 2 hours a day, but only of moderate intensity exercise. We're talking about heart rate not going much about 150 beats per minute. No, so between 120, 150, we might say moderate exercise. So it's a bit more than doing just walking. It's sort of jogging or, you know, cycling on the flat and that sort of thing. Swimming as well, I suppose. But yeah, when you start doing more than that, that's when you it starts to go the other way.
And even if it's moderate, so if you're doing like 3 hours, because I guess it gets a bit hard to compare, because the more people do, the more they start to throw in more intense training and things like that. So
So it's a combination. It's kind of the overall training load. Great. So it's a combination of the frequency, the intensity, and the duration of the exercise. And that's kind of what the was involved in an IOC consensus about training load and illness a few years ago. And that was the overall consensus that came out, that the illness risk amongst athletes certainly was related to their overall sort of weekly training load.
All right, so that's good news that most people, you know, your average punter, average recreational person, even someone who's relatively serious, like an hour a day, every day. But again, I guess it starts getting a bit, you know, not tedious, but between the weeds, trying to work it. So if you're doing an hour a day every day and you're doing, you know, as you said, it's the overall stress. So if you're doing hard one day, easy the next, an hour a day might almost put you on the borderline, or do you think you'd still be fine doing that?
Oh, no, I think you'd be fine with that. What it's doing is you're getting this, you know, immunosurveillance enhancement that you get with doing the exercise and probably for several hours after, while your blood cell, white blood cell count is elevated and not depressed, that you're getting the benefit. And if you do that day after day after day on a regular basis, you're probably likely getting a cumulative benefit as well. So becoming fitter as well by doing that can also actually help to improve your immune defense. And what's really shown this, I think, and really brought this home, it's the COVID-19 epidemic. Because you know, lots of studies have been done on that now, you know, retrospectively looking back at how many people who got severe symptoms of illness or were hospitalized, had to go to the intensive care unit, or actually died from COVID. You know, being physically active and fit, and also not overweight, ideally, was a major defender against getting hospitalized when you got infected, having to go into the intensive care unit, how long you stayed there if you had to go there, and whether or not you survived at the end of the day. So physical activity, body adiposity, and fitness are three factors that all seem to do us some good. Not in actually stopping the infection, because if we touch on COVID for a minute, the big difference where it was with COVID-19, it was a totally new infection to the human immune system. We'd not been exposed to it before, and it was highly contagious. So it probably didn't really matter whether you were active or inactive, whether you had a good diet or a bad diet. If you got exposed to that virus, you were going to come down with some symptoms. But it was the severity of those symptoms that was crucial in determining whether you were hospitalized or whether you ended up alive or dead at the end of the day after that. And probably the thing that's saving people with the exercise is not only this immune surveillance thing, but it's actually having this sort of anti-inflammatory overall body effect with exercise. Because if you're overweight and you have large amounts of adipose tissue, those cells become infiltrated with white blood cells, and they get activated and they produce a pro-inflammatory state. And this is what seems to predispose people to problems with infections like COVID. They get infected, they have a large pro-inflammatory immune response, and in part that is damaging. Sometimes it's not only the virus that damages your cells, it's the actual immune response to it And if you get excessive inflammation in the lungs where this virus was targeting, you then get you end up with acute respiratory distress syndrome because of the accumulation of fluid. It's one of the things that happens when you get inflammation in a tissue, and that makes breathing difficult. And ultimately, that was what killed people.
I definitely heard a lot of, about pre-existing illnesses, especially obesity, being a big risk factor for poor outcomes with COVID. Have they been able to stratify out, so at the same level of obesity as the exercise? I'm assuming it was, but exercise was protective, same.
So even with exercise was protective, at least to a degree, even with people with obesity, with people with type 2 diabetes, and other, comorbidities as well. So it didn't only protect the very healthy. Doing some exercise, being physically active, at least up to the normal sort of ACSM or UK guideline for physical activity, which isn't a huge amount, confers some benefit. And that's generally what you see with most of the benefits of exercise in terms
Absolutely.
Of sort of, the chronic diseases. The biggest effect you get is with doing actually just enough exercise. And then beyond that, there's something of a sort of a dose response effect. But the biggest benefit comes from going from doing absolutely nothing to just becoming sort of, moderately active.
Without getting political here, it was a pity it wasn't particularly pushed in Australia. I don't know about it, but in England, about exercise, to help you with not preventing getting COVID, as you said, but improving your outcomes. And indeed, we were the most locked down city in the world at one stage in Melbourne. We had 15 months of lockdown, so that people were not particularly active. Although there was a lot of people jumping around in front of their TVs. The 7 minute.
Oh yeah. You got the old. Treadmill or cyclogometer in the garage, and that's what we were doing, or actually cheating and going out very early in the morning before anybody was about and getting our dose of exercise in before anybody else was up, because it was all
it's definitely on the podcast. I think we've seen over and over and over and over that exercise is good for you, no matter what it is. If you talk about your immune system, talk about cardiovascular function, respiratory function, insulin sensitivity. But one thing I thought of as you mentioned walking, I had Ben Levine on at one stage, who's an expert on cardiovascular system and exercise, and he was saying that walking is great for your metabolic health, but not really intense enough for cardiovascular responses, so VO2 max, etc. Now I think you mentioned walking, are you saying you need to do a bit more than just sort of normal walking for the immune sort of benefits, or
there's not been many studies actually that have been done specifically on walking as an exercise in terms of immune benefits. It's mostly focused on the sort of the more moderate activity where there's a real effect. I guess walking becomes somewhere in between. But then again, when you go for walks, you tend to probably be involved in the activity for quite a lot longer than if you're doing if you're having a jog or going out on a bike. So it may well be that combination of walking, particularly if you're doing brisk walking rather than just strolling along, if you do that for an hour, a couple of hours, which mostly what me and the wife do, really. We tend to go out for a brisk walk in the countryside, and if you're doing a bit of uphill, it's a little bit harder, of course. That probably ends up being quite similar in terms of benefit to what we were saying with the moderate exercise. So that 1 hour of moderate exercise per day, 5 days a week, that seems to give you the optimal benefit. You'll still get some benefit, I'm sure, from doing anything more than being a couch potato.
And again, reducing your chance of becoming obese, which we're saying is a pro-inflammatory situation. And also walking in the countryside sounds good for your stress levels as well.
Indeed, yeah. And you can actually still have a conversation while you're walking along and enjoy the scenery.
Hey, I was just thinking of something my mum used to always say. And it's that, if you go, because I'd go for a run and then I'd be sitting around, oh, you got to catch a death. You're going to catch catch a cold because you haven't, you know, kept yourself warm after exercise. That always felt like a little bit of a unlikely. Do you know, it's a bit of a strange one, but is there, if you exercise and then stand around cold, are you more likely to, you know, catch a cold, I guess?
Okay. Well, yeah, there's two lines of research we could discuss there. One is sort of laboratory-based studies where you compare the immune response to doing, say, an hour of hard exercise in, you know, in a normal room temperature, say around 15, 20 degrees. And you compare that with doing exactly the same exercise in a room that's close to freezing. And maybe even with increased humidity in the room. So those studies show really absolutely no difference in the immune response to the exercise, whether you did it in the cold or in a temperate or even in a hot environment. So that doesn't seem to have an effect. But then there are other ones that you could read about that suggest that if you just cool the feet, surprisingly, or if you I think it's to do with the vasoconstriction going on, and if you're breathing cold air in and out, that you get this decreased ciliary action in your nose, and that you're often where the infections actually gain entry. So there may be something in it because of those effects, but not like you go out for a run in the wet and you're more likely to become infected. I mean, when we talk about this issue of infection in people, athletes or ordinary people, at the end of the day, whether or not you get infected not only depends on the status of your immune system, whether it's, you know, hunky-dory or whether it's depressed, but also, you know, whether to what degree are you being exposed to viruses and ones that might cause the common cold in your immediate environment. So maybe if you go out for a run in the cold and the wet, and then you go down the pub and you mix with a bunch of your mates down there socializing, you're perhaps more likely to pick up something there. So it's a combination of exposure to the pathogen and your defense in your body from your immune system against it.
There you go. So no one's done my mum study there. So you exercise and then you stand around the cold. Because, you know, you go and you go to your footy training or whatever, and then you're standing around waiting for the bus and you're freezing cold, or just freezing cold, full stop. Does that actually make you get sick?
No. We know the study's been done on athletes involved in winter sport, you know, where they're in snowy, icy conditions, your alpine skiers and that. And they don't seem to get any more higher incidence of infection than your endurance runners who are running around in temperate and warm climates. So there doesn't seem to be anything in it from simply due to cold exposure, at least not in athletes.
All right. So I think it sounds like we can knock that one on the head. Now, what were some of the questions we talked about beforehand? So what about nutrition? So we've talked a lot about exercise. We've done a lot with nutrition. We touched on a few bits and pieces there with the carbohydrate ingestion and you mentioned vitamin D and all that. So what do you think about that with nutrition plus or minus exercise and the immune system?
Yeah, okay. Well, in terms of risk of infection, unless you're actually deficient in a particular nutrient, and for most things we won't be, but for certain ones like vitamin D, which we mostly get from sunlight rather than from the diet, if you're not deficient in anything, there's nothing you can really take that's really going to kind of boost your immunity in terms of your resistance to infection. And again, we saw this with COVID, the contagious virus. Nothing you ate or drank or supplemented with could prevent you from picking up that infection. But what it did on the other side was nutrition can certainly influence immune tolerance. And that's our ability to actually endure or put up with a microbe without being too damaging to our own tissues. So things like vitamin D, omega-3 fatty acids from fish oil, zinc, an important mineral, many enzymes involved in immunity and immune defense, those sorts of things. If you are deficient in those, it could impair your immunity and increase your risk of picking up infections. But being deficient in those might mean you also are less tolerant to the infection when you get infected. So you end up by getting more severe and longer lasting illness symptoms. And again, that's what's been shown with COVID. People who had low vitamin D status compared to people who were, you know, adequate or optimal high vitamin D status, they didn't necessarily get more infections, but they got, again, more severe and debilitating infections, and the risk of death and hospitalization was increased in the people who had these nutrient deficiencies.
And that's the thing, I guess, that tends to get lost sometimes. You mentioned deficiency over and over, but I remember seeing a whole bunch of stuff on Twitter, like, oh, if you've got COVID, you need to take zinc, vitamin D, boom, boom, boom. But it wasn't like if you're deficient, you know, it's often just race out there and buy. At one stage, it was sort of like I saw a cocktail of 10 different things when I had COVID, people were suggesting I should take.
Because most people, of course, won't know exactly what their vitamin D or zinc status is. So it's almost, you know, as a just in case sort of thing that might help. We do encourage athletes to take vitamin D supplements on a regular basis, particularly during the winter months when you haven't got strong enough sunlight to produce vitamin D in the body. And the status will go down over time if you don't do that. The best thing to do is have something like 2,000 international units per day. Yeah, countries like that. Anywhere above the level of, say, Madrid or somewhere like that in Europe is going to be suffering the consequences of that. So, and vitamin C, which has been shown in people who exercise or do these prolonged marathons and ultramarathon races, that it decreases their risk of developing an illness following those endurance events. If you've been having vitamin C of the order of sort of 500, 600 milligrams a day, at least a few weeks in the lead up to the event.
Okay, so
there seems to be some protection, maybe whether that's an antioxidant effect or whether it's because it's something that's required as part of the for immune functions, like neutrophil function, where they have to generate an oxidative burst activity. Seems to be beneficial there.
Yeah, because vitamin C has been discussed for many years. But again, is that something where you'd need to have a deficiency, or are you saying even, you know, if you're leading up to a, which again is a small number of people that are training for an ultra marathon, you think even if you've got normal levels of vitamin C, it would be beneficial to up the dose to have a 500 milligrams a day or something?
That's what the results seem to show. Now, whether you'd want to do that kind of routinely, you know, for your average athlete who's probably not going to run ultra marathons, is you know, debatable, because we've seen these other studies indicating that if you have too high a dose of particularly vitamin C and vitamin E in combination in high doses, that you may impair your training adaptations, which obviously no athlete wants to do. So we're not advocating taking really high doses of vitamin C or combining that with vitamin E, but just maybe 200 milligrams a day as a routine. That seems to be enough to saturate your tissue stores with vitamin C. I mean, it's a water-soluble vitamin, so it gets excreted in the urine. And, you know, you have to keep up your dosage to maintain your status. And when people get ill, one of the recommendations is that increase your vitamin C intake, possibly also your zinc intake as well, as that might help you actually combat the infection. Not, you've already got the infection, so you're not preventing it, but getting in, but you're hopefully going to reduce the duration of the illness or lower the severity of your symptoms, so it's easier to get back to your exercise quicker.
I was just thinking how I'm like, if you've seen many of my podcasts, I'm usually not that big a fan of supplements. And I say, you know, if you have a normal diet, whatever. But I'm just thinking, when I got COVID, I had it for like at least 8 weeks. 8 weeks, I felt crap. But then longer and longer and had some lung problems and things. So here I was not taking anything. I didn't take any supplements. So my little N=1 here, obviously it's not scientific, but
yeah.
Maybe it wouldn't have done any harm taking some of these things. So I was just thinking also, back in the, I guess it was 90s when I was first hearing it, there was a lot of talk about the immune system with overtraining and things like that. And then later on, it's sort of like, do you know if it's overtrained or overreached, et cetera? So I know you touched on that a little bit when you got some athletes and you sort of doubled their training, I think you said, and they got But I remember at that time, there's a lot of looking at cortisol, testosterone ratios and salivary cortisol and things like that. So where are we at with that? And do you think overtraining is something that I don't know, I guess we've already talked about that, but what about overreaching versus overtraining? Is it people really looking at that?
Overreach is essentially what we mean when an athlete does, you know, an intensified period of training, and normally that will be probably between 1 to 3 weeks. And that will quite often be in the lead up to a major competition. And then they'll have about a few days or at least maybe up to a week of tapering before they compete. Mm-hmm. Because you're just aiming to get that extra adaptation, of course, in those few weeks of intensified training that you can then benefit from, provided you have the recovery before you actually engage in competition. And those sort of studies, have been done and clearly show this sort of lowering of immunity that you get with this cumulative effect of day after day without recovery days of doing hard exercise for a prolonged period.
I'm realizing now what I was getting at when I was going around and around in circles. What I was trying to get at, I think, was there was a lot of talk about trying to use salivary cortisol and things as an indicator of whether someone is overtraining. So as you said, overreaching is sort of like a normal, you know, you do a bit more and then you taper and you might even do better, et cetera. But there was, for a while, a lot of trying to pick up, how do we tell if someone's overtrained or not?
So yeah, we were looking for these sort of biomarkers that might indicate whether overtraining had occurred, or ideally, you know, that there was an increasing risk of it developing. But in the sort of studies that can be practically done, you know, in sort of university laboratories and the like, where most of this research tends to be done, you can show that if you do intensified periods of training, then yes, you're getting increases in cortisol in men. You'll also see the decrease in testosterone along with that, and that cortisol testosterone ratio has always been suggested as a reasonable marker of stress if you measure that in a morning sample, blood sample before any exercise. You know, if it's elevated, maybe you're already in a bit of a stress condition. You should perhaps not do too much more that particular day. And markers of immunity as well. Now, the trouble with measuring immune function in the laboratory is you're taking a blood sample, you're measuring cell count, you're then trying to measure some aspects of function. And these things are quite time-consuming assays, and they're expensive. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you're only measuring one aspect of immunity, one or two aspects of immunity that are part of a very multifaceted and, you know, variety system. So you might not necessarily picking up on which are the best measures for actually defending you against viral infections, which is the main thing you'd want to know. And then came on board the salivary assays. We're using enzyme-linked immunoassays. You could measure the concentration of cortisol and testosterone in saliva. That makes it potentially a more practical tool to use with athletes. Wouldn't mind giving you a spit sample, but they don't want a needle stuck in them every few days to check what their hormone levels are. And you could also measure the concentration of salivary IgA or immunoglobulin A, which is a type of antibody which is present in, it's in your saliva, but it's also representative of what's in your upper airways in the mucosal tissues lining your airways going down into the lungs. And that is actually the only immune measure that I know of that has actually been shown to have some association with risk of infection. And that's been done with studies where saliva samples have been taken on a weekly basis throughout, say, a whole year for a bunch of athletes. And then also at the same time recording their infection symptoms over that year, and then making the association. I mean, do you see when they are actually suffering from infection, is their salivary IgA lower, or was it lower in a week or two or three before they actually picked up the infection? And that seems to show a positive association, such that if an athlete had something like a 40% or more drop in their level of salivary IgA, then they'd be more likely, but quite as likely, to pick up an infection in the next couple of weeks or so. So, but I think the idea of using markers is largely on a routine basis for testing athletes, it has largely gone out of the window. Partly, I think, because of the increased education that we've got, and you know, the proactive people who are supporting athletes, looking at things like their vitamin D status and monitoring their training load, realizing that being deficient in anything, particularly those things like iron and zinc and vitamin C and vitamin D, isn't a good thing. So, sort of monitoring their diet, see what they're eating. You can test vitamin D status with a blood sample quite easily. So, with COVID as well, all this information that's come on board, people realizing that it's a combination again of exposure to pathogen and the state of your immune system that determines your risk of picking up infection. And all the things you can do about that, like, avoiding sick people when you need to. I mean, we call it social distancing and lockdown in COVID, but it's the same principle. Don't go into a crowded room of people if you've got a competition coming up, if you can avoid it. And you can wear a face mask to reduce transmission through droplets in the air, things like that. And you can practice good personal hygiene, washing your hands, using these alcohol gels or whatever, to minimize your risk of transferring bugs from surfaces to your eyes, ears and nose.
Exactly. All right. So just starting to think about finishing up, I've got a question here on Twitter from Mark. What are the most evident hypotheses of how exercise is beneficial for immune function? Is it exokines? What do you think about that? The mechanisms?
As I mentioned earlier, we think the main benefit of doing the moderate exercise is this increase in the white blood cell number, this flushing into cells that are primed to fight infection from the blood vessel walls into the circulation in the absence of any functional depression of those immune cells. And that's sort of that the accepted.
The hormones, version. the shear stress on the blood vessels. Is there any way it could be the exokines? Do we know? So the exokines,
I'll define it if you like. As I understand it, it's essentially potentially signaling molecules that are released from, it can be a variety of tissues. It can be from immune cells. It could be from the muscle itself. It could be from adipose tissues. So we have what are called myokines from muscle, adipokine from adipose tissue, hepatokine from the liver, you know, and there's probably a whole host of others as well. And when we exercise, we can see increases in the circulation of these various signaling molecules. So they're having some effect. I mean, the ones that are coming from muscle, which are probably, you might think, are the most important if we're talking about exercise. The main ones that are released in response to exercise is IL-6. This then induces an increase. And that IL-6, of course, is actually coming from the muscle fibers. It's not actually coming from white blood cells. Although classically, it's considered as a cytokine, which we normally associate with coming from white blood cells. This actually was coming from contracting muscle, particularly in response to the lowering of muscle glycogen levels. And there's a reason for that, because it does actually have some metabolic effects itself. It increases free fatty acid mobilization from adipose tissue, and it stimulates liver glycogen breakdown. So you're supplying the muscle with a little bit extra fuel as its muscle glycogen stores are running out. That's probably the main reason why it comes from muscle, but it also induces this anti-inflammatory cascade with increases in IL-10 and other things as well, acting to provide an anti-inflammatory milieu to the body. So, I mean, some of the other things that come out of muscle, there's also IL-7, which actually promotes the release of T cells from the thymus. And there's IL-15, which also comes from muscle, which increases with exercise and is thought to help maintain the natural killer cell population and the T cell population in the circulation. So there's a potential for some of these exokines, if we collectively call them that. The term was only coined first in about 2016, so it's not a very old term. But we've had the myokine since the year 2000 with IL-6. So it's possible there could be some contributions there, but I think the prevailing theory still is this increased immunosurveillance effect with the moderate intensity exercise that's responsible for the reduction in the infection incidence. And if you wanted to quantify it, the biggest benefit we seem to get with about an hour of exercise, moderate exercise a day, 5 days a week, is something like a 30 to 50% reduction in the number of infections we might get each year.
Now, just to, I had another question that was sent through. It was actually an email someone sent me a while back. This just made me think, I want to get my head straight around this. So you said during exercise, you get an increase in your white blood cell count, but you can get a reduction in the function if you're doing hard exercise. But then these athletes that are doing a lot of exercise, do they have a normal white blood cell count? Is that right? Or is it actually elevated, you said?
Well, if you measure it at rest in an athlete, they don't go outside the normal range. A lot of studies tend to show they have slightly lower numbers, particularly of lymphocytes in their circulation. But you know, when you ask the clinicians, is that something that might influence, you know, their chance of picking up infections in general? They'll generally say no. You know, it's got to fall considerably lower than that before the actual cell number is going to have any potential effect. But you always have these compensatory mechanisms. You might have fewer lymphocytes, but you might have more neutrophil. So again, there's all these different aspects of immunity working in concert in the body, and it's difficult to take any isolated measure and say, well, that's what's responsible for, you know, getting more infections.
Yeah, because I got this email from this chap, and it might just be what you're saying, as things bounce around. It could also be measurement error, because he said, I remember having a blood test. It was on a recovery day after a hard threshold effort the day before, about 2 hours, and the leukocyte count was very low, 2,190. This was restored back up to normal levels, well, about 4,000 to 5,000 mark, at the retest a week later, I had no illness nor anything untoward, just training a lot. So I guess that got me thinking, you know, how do things change day to day versus a week? But this is one person having their blood test.
I mean, with the exercise, particularly with the prolonged exercise, you do get quite large increases in the neutrophils, which are great at defending you against bacteria, but not so great in helping defend you against viruses, because they're part of the innate immune system. But with the numbers of lymphocytes and perhaps natural killer cells in particular, they'll go up during the exercise, usually, but then they'll come down below normal several hours after the exercise. And originally, this was referred to as the open window for infection, and this was what was thought the problem with athletes, that they were okay during the exercise, but then as soon as they stop, the numbers return back to normal, but they were dipping down below normal, a bit like your insulin rebound effect, you know, with having carbohydrate, and that might be responsible. But it's. As things progress, as they do in science, you realize that, you know, there's no simple explanation that. It's a more complex thing. There's other factors, like I said, with the diet and the sleep quality and the psychological stress aspect, all having their individual or even combined impact. I'm not sure your body distinguishes that much between different forms of stress. And if you've got more than one, it can be an additive effect.
That's true. Now, what about sex differences and age differences? So we've been probably talking, you know, we tend to think about, you know, the textbooks are always your 70 kilogram male, and we're assuming, you know, this just, you know, 20 to 30 or something. What about females? Do we know much about sex differences and the effect of age? So, you know, we're superimposing on this sort of levels of exercise.
Age in itself doesn't necessarily increase your sort of risk of infection, or the number of infections you might get per year. In fact, the people who get the most frequent infections are actually children, because their immune systems are not fully developed. Mm-hmm. And then we get to adulthood, and there's not a huge change over the lifespan in actual risk of picking up infections. It's just that as you age, and there is a degree of what's called immunosenescence, where you kind of run out of the ability to produce new T cells that can respond to new pathogens. So if something new comes along, like COVID, you know, the older people are going to be more susceptible both picking it up, and they tend not to respond as well, or they tend to have a more pro-inflammatory response. Because a lot of people put on weight as well and are not as fit as you get older. So there's that effect. As far as the female go, it's a bit of a conundrum, because if you look at infection amongst the general population, then generally females tend to get fewer infections. But when we look at athletes, and this has been monitored in major games like the Olympics, both the Winter Olympics and the Summer Olympics, International Amateur Athletic Federation meetings and things like that, Youth Olympics, as well as for the adults. There you see, on average, for 2 to 3 week games, you'll see about 7% of athletes reporting that they've picked up an infection during that time. And about half of those will be respiratory, or maybe 60% if it's winter, 40% if it's in the summer month. But when you look at the difference between males and females, the average overall is 7%, but for the males it's like 5 or 6%, and for the females on average, 9 or 10% of them that have actually registered to compete at the games and turn up, that actually report they've got an picked up some sort of infection. And there's no real clear explanation for that. There are some subtle immune differences between males and females. If you look at it, your blood samples in the resting state, you can see slight differences in numbers of some cells, like natural killer cells and things like that. And females tend to have this, a lower salivary IgA, which is one of the things that does help seem to be associated with upper airway protection. Again, that, you know, so some people say it actually proves the old adage that, you know, the females are the weaker sex, but I couldn't possibly comment on that.
Oh, you just said they get less sick generally, though. So that's only at the Olympics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So why there's a switch from being sort of
the strongest
inactive or recreation active to when you become to this stress? Maybe, you know, if in some way some of these stresses are affecting the females more, they tend to, more of the females tend to have this do with low energy availability, and that might be a contributing factor, particularly if they're not eating enough protein, and or if they're not eating enough of the micronutrients. You know, maybe they're more likely to becoming deficient in some of these essential minerals and vitamins that they need for their normal immune function. So I've never seen a satisfactory explanation for that phenomenon, but it is reported, you know, year after year. This sort of monitoring has been going on for about the last 15 years, where, you know, the athletes and the medics who are supporting them are asked to report, you know, what have they got in terms of injuries or infections, illnesses picked up while they've been at the games. So they're going to have a big captive population to study. And that seems to be, yeah, an issue amongst a bigger issue for the females than for the males.
Oh, that's interesting. Hey, one thing I was just thinking of is I was trying to think, females generally are juggling more, you know, life, you know, more like they're looking after kids and, you know, trying to, you know, they've got more stresses generally to try and keep up with males. I mean, for example, I had Abby Smith Ryan on talking about, you know, academics, females versus males and the sort of different levels of stresses and things.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking, that doesn't fit, because I was almost thinking, you know, that would be then taken away by going to the Olympics, because then the males and females would have the same sort of stress, right? But you know what I mean? Like they've all the normal sort of life stresses, kids and whatever else, and more likely to be making decisions around the house and whatever, that'd actually be gone when you go to the Olympics, because everyone's just focusing on the event. But anyway, it made me think of something
else. I was always told that by people like my wife, that females are much better at multitasking than men.
Well, I think they might be as well. But anyway, it just made me think somehow about this weird thing about, you know, you'll be cranking away to get grants done, or you'll be cranking away to get your teaching prepared and everything before the Christmas holidays or something. And then you suddenly go, you can collapse and go, all right, now I can relax. And then you get sick. Do you know, this is, I'm sure, not your main area of focus, but is that like a thing, or is that just something that seems to happen? You've got that stress sort of thing, you keep going, and as soon as you sort of take a holiday, you get sick. That's just what it feels like.
I've heard that from the sort of the psychological stress point of view, that, you know, it's sort of small, relatively frequent episodes of stress can you know, not detrimental to immune function. But if you get chronic psychological stress that lasts a long time and doesn't go away, then that's the thing that really depresses immunity and increases infection risk. So maybe we need to relieve a little bit of the stress on the ladies.
So why do you tend to get sick? Maybe it doesn't actually happen. It's probably just it feels like it. So, you know, you have 10 holidays. And the eight of them you don't get sick, and two of them you do. You go, oh, every time I stop, I get sick. You know what I mean? It's probably not actually borne out by evidence.
Don't think so. No, not that I know of.
Now, the other thing, just before we do our take-home messages at the end here, was you're talking about how kids get sick. And remember, for a while there, it was always, you know, got to be so clean with them. You know, make sure they're clean the whole time. Don't let them crawl around and pick up anything and stick it in their mouth. And then there was this talk about, again, sorry, because it's not sports or, you know, nutrition and exercise. But then there was this talk about, hang on, you want them to actually get their immune system stimulated. And believe it or not, I always gross people out by saying this, but I saw a paper at one stage, they said actually kids picking their nose and eating it was actually good for their immune system because they're actually getting some immune stimulation from that. So just for a gross sort of finishing up point here, do you know where that the data is on that? You know, that I think it's moved away a little bit. So, you know, you're not so worried about kids picking up something and sticking in their mouth, you know, wash their mouth out with soap and water.
Yeah. Well, I think essentially a lack of exposure to potentially, pathogenic viruses and bacteria at an early age means your immune system is not prepared to adapt and fight it, and also gain immunological memory that will protect you later in life. So I think that's the mechanism we're talking
makes
about here.
Sense.
It's like if you live in isolation in a bubble and you're never exposed to anything, you come out of that bubble, you're going to catch everything that's going.
It makes extreme sense. But I remember when our kids are now 25 and 23, but it was like, oh, don't let them put anything in them. Don't get them touch any dirt or anything. It makes extreme sense.
There's a balance. You don't want kids to get infected too much, but they're always going to pick up things at school and playing with their playmates and things. So you don't need to worry about it too much, but don't over worry about that.
All right. So this has been great. So what I like to do at the end is just have some sort of takeaway messages for people from the chat. Two or three things or four or whatever you like. Takeaways you'd like people to get from this chat.
Okay. First thing, probably that exercise we do know affects the status of your immune system. It's good to be doing some regular moderate exercise for your immunity, and it has been associated with decreased infection risk, particularly for the common cold, which is the thing that the most frequent cause of infection amongst us. But doing too much exercise can take it the other way. So it's not something most people need to worry about. It's the elite endurance athlete that we're really talking about there. Those who aren't involved in that type of, intensive, prolonged training, it shouldn't really be a concern. We've also seen with COVID, I think it's important to emphasize that if you're inactive when you get infected with something that you can't really avoid, like the COVID virus, then you are severely increasing your risk of having much worse symptoms and longer lasting infection symptoms. And for COVID, it was something that potentially affected your risk of actually dying from the bug. So that's important. I don't want people to go in any way to go away with the message that exercise is bad for your immune system in general. As we said, it's good for many aspects of health, ranging from metabolic to, as you said, metabolic and the
cardiovascular and all sorts of things.
Cardiovascular health and your blood pressure, of course, and things like that, and lowering your blood lipid levels. You're also helping to keep your adiposity down. And, the less fat we carry around, particularly in our abdomen for the men, it's something we need to try and achieve. So that inflammation is what puts you in the pro-inflammatory state that makes you much more susceptible to not tolerating these nasty bugs once they get into your system.
Just when you thought you were done, just thinking about getting sick and whether you should exercise or not. So that's an old classic. I remember I used to always get a bad cough when I was a distance runner and even be on like antibiotics and things. And I did these sort of experiments. Sometimes I'd feel like if I just rested for like a whole week, I'd recover in, 10 days or something. But if I actually went out and ran every day, even though I was coughing the whole time, it still felt like it was 10 days as well. And now you've increased the risk of getting I had someone I used to run with at one stage got pericarditis by actually pushing it when she had an infection. But is there much, what's the sort of evidence on that? If you're a bit sick, is it okay to exercise at a low level or do you make it more likely? I don't know if it's the data on this.
The general advice is that, If you've got symptoms that are exclusively above the neck, No, it's just your nose, and you've got a sore throat, runny nose, and you haven't got a fever, then you're probably okay to just carry on doing, you know, moderate training. Maybe drop your level a little bit, you know, and don't overdo it. But if you have symptoms below the neck, so we're talking about fever, we might be talking about a chesty cough rather than one that's coming from your throat, or if you've got aching joint, then, I mean, it's possible that then that you might actually have something worse than the common cold. You might actually have picked up influenza or something that. And in that situation, it's recommended that you actually stop exercise altogether until those symptoms start to reduce. And then maybe wait even until you've had one day pretty much symptom free before you resume. And don't go back straight into it at the same level, you know, build up a little bit more gradually over that first week coming back after illness. Because once these viruses get in your system, we've not really touched on this, but, you know, they can hang around and they'll be kept at a tolerable level. Again, coming back to the issue of immune tolerance, your immune system will keep it at a tolerable level, so it won't, you know, cause you illness symptoms, but it's still kind of there in the background in your body. And if your immune system does get depressed by too much stress, physical or psychological or lack of sleep or whatever, then that virus can reactivate, come back, and then you start to develop the symptoms again. And this is what we see with sort of particular infections like glandular fever caused by Epstein-Barr virus and those sort of problems. That's always around once you've had it. And, you know, anytime your immune system depressed, that can come back. And it's probably true of many, many sorts of infections as well.
Right. All right. Well, that makes sense. So I was actually thinking, because I've had this chronic asthma, I was telling you before we come on, so I have inhaled steroids morning and night and things. But I also got like nodules on my larynx and things. So it's always been a bit vague. My cough is coming from the chest or the throat. So maybe that's how I actually got through it. And it was quite similar. It was probably the throat, not the chest. It makes sense if you've got anything in your chest.
If you are susceptible to those sort of respiratory issues, like to do with asthma and bronchitis and that if you when you exercise, you might actually sometimes get, you know, symptoms that appear to be common cold, like runny nose, sore throat, you know, particularly upper airways and that. And but bear in mind, it can also be caused by inhaling cold or sometimes hot, dry or polluted air. And these things will trigger an inflammatory reaction at the back of your throat, which give you symptoms very similar to what is an actual infectious episode. Mm. That's been one of the challenges, or one of the problems, if you like, in doing exercise immunology research, where you're looking to see whether a certain type of exercise or some sort of other intervention, like a supplement or a diet change or whatever, does it have an influence on the number of infections you get over a number of months? Then, you know, that's a complication, because most studies have not, you know, really confirmed the presence of infection by measuring, you know, the presence of a virus. I mean, we've been able to do that with COVID when they came up with these, you know, tests that allowed you to do a sample from your saliva, and, you know, it'll detect whether or not the virus is present. But there are so many different viruses that can cause the common cold, it's virtually impossible to do that kind of thing. So you're relying really on sort of symptom questionnaires to establish whether somebody has an infection or not. You have certain cutoffs, you know, there's how severe their sore throat is, how severe their runny nose is, and how long those symptoms are lasting for. That's sort of your criteria measure for whether they've actually got an infection, or whether it's something just like, well, they had those symptoms, they only lasted a day, in which case it was probably just airway irritation.
What if it's bacterial as well?
Well, you won't be able to tell the difference between the symptoms, but probably more than 90% of sore throats, common colds are caused by viruses. Streptococcal infection can cause inflammation of the infection of the tonsils, and that's the main bacterial one, or possibly in rare cases, bacterial pneumonia, but that's usually only after people have been ill for some other reason and have become hospitalised and are pretty much totally sedentary for a period of time.
Oh, great. Yeah, I could keep going. I always do this. I do the takeaway messages, and then I have more questions, but I'll let you go. So thank you very much for coming on, Mike. It's been great.
It's been a real pleasure, Glenn.
Yeah, great. Okay, nice to meet you, and take care. See you.
All the best. Bye now.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.